the existing structure of GATT and what will also be established with NAFTA, the dispute resolution structure takes power away from local people, local right to set our laws and our standards for the environment, for health, and those kinds of things, and puts it at an international super government, if you will, which is accountable to no one, elected by no one, and operates in complete secrecy.
In 1914, Henry Ford paid his workers $5 a day so that the workers would be able to buy the products which they produced. We're in 1992, and the wages in some of these plants are still $5 a day.
Also, the companies in the maquiladora area are not responsible corporate citizens. What they do is they dump their hazardous and toxic waste into the rivers, into the sewer systems, into landfills. They are not protecting the workers.
The establishment media and the politicians are not telling you of the dire consequences of the GATT agreements and the North American Free Trade Agreement. But we have three experts who are going to tell you about some of these right now on Alternative Views. There is a revolution in the works right now, and Americans don't even know about it, or maybe are dimly aware about it, and that is regarding the North American Free Trade Agreement and the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, known as NAFTA and GATT. I say revolution, it's one which has incredible effects, it will have incredible impact on you as individual citizens, as workers, as somebody just trying to maintain your health, and also in the political atmosphere, doing away with democracy as we know it. We're going to emphasize on this program of Alternative Views the North American Free Trade Agreement, what effect it's had on Mexico, it can have on Mexico and on the United States, and its relationship also with the agreement that's already in effect with Canada, and what has happened in a fait accompli North American Free Trade Agreement, in a sense, a mini agreement, with the maquiladoras on the Mexico and American border.
We'd like to welcome Sister Susan Mika, a Benedictine sister with the San Antonio-based Coalition for Justice in the Maquiladoras. Also with us today are Mary Ann Neely, co-director of the Texas Chapter of Clean Water Action, and James Scott, a policy analyst with Public Citizens Texas Office and the Texas field organizer of the Fair Trade Campaign. James, I'd like to start with you. What exactly is the NAFTA agreement?
Well, the North American Free Trade Agreement is a broad agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico that'll rework our trading relationship with those two countries. It is based on or in addition to the existing U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement. And what it does is it lowers tariffs, affects a number of different trade barriers, lowering trade barriers between the countries. On a range of different products and commodities, from anywhere from automotive parts to intellectual property rights. It renegotiates transportation issues, renegotiates agricultural subsidies, things like that. It affects basically every aspect of American life and Mexican life, just about every different, every economic activity you can imagine.
Well, James, we hear the establishment people say, oh, well, this, we're helping free trade, and free trade is a good thing. What are the dangers in this NAFTA agreement?
Well, free trade in and of itself probably is a good thing. The problem we see here are a number of issues that are going to be exacerbated by the free trade agreement. We have a severe border pollution problem. We have a rapidly industrializing border with thousands of U.S.-owned plants which dump toxic wastes into the Rio Grande River, the New River. We have worker exploitation on the Mexican side of the border. Essentially what this agreement really is a opportunity for U.S. multinational corporations to have an easier access to cheap labor in order to maintain competitiveness in the world. The problems we see are basically worker exploitation in Mexico, a general lowering of wages in the United States as plants move from the United States to Mexico to take advantage of weak environmental regulations and low wage and labor costs, and environmental degradation primarily in Mexico and on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, they say that it's going to be free trade, so goods are going to move across the border without tariffs. Does this mean also that laborers are going to be able to go from Mexico to the U.S. and seeking better lives and better wages, or maybe U.S. workers will go to Canada to take advantage of the benefits there, or is it just for the corporations?
Well, essentially, it's just for the corporations. The reality is this is not free trade. It's managed trade. A true free trade agreement would involve the free flow of all goods, services, and commodities, including labor as a commodity of itself. This is not free trade, it's managed trade. There are certain industries that have the ear of the trade negotiators, the ear of the administration, which maintain certain protections. Mexico maintained protections of certain of its industries. It basically is who you know, whether or not you're going to be protected and maintain your the existing protections preceding the free trade agreement. So, no, there won't be free migration. That's not in the interest of corporate America or corporate Mexico. And that's essentially managed trade system that we're proposing right now.
James, in studying about the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, they're wanting to set up an elaborate international organization which will supersede state, local, and national laws. And they'll have secret panels which will determine which how the international economic system will work and try to reduce any barriers or eliminate any barriers or impediments to any type of free flow of trade. That means that if U.S. has environmental laws, they're out. If the United States has labor laws, they're out. All of this will be done by these secret panels, which are composed of the bureaucrats of GATT and also the big corporations. And so the democracy is just gone. Now, is the same thing being set up with NAFTA, or is...
Absolutely. The issue comes when there is a dispute between two countries in any type of trade arrangement. Under GATT, GATT is the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade has existed since the post-war era. Under existing GATT, you have this issue of one country challenging another country or claiming unfair trade practices. We've seen U.S. environmental laws challenged and indeed ordered to be struck down by foreign bureaucrats. The most noted example is the issue of tuna and dolphins. The U.S. has Marine Mammal Protection Act, which protects dolphins from tuna fishing methods, which are an encircling method, which trap and kill thousands and thousands of dolphins. The U.S. is not allowed to, so there's no tuna sold in the U.S. caught using these methods. Mexico and Venezuela, under the existing GATT, challenged that Marine Mammal Protection Act as a barrier to trade. We were inhibiting free trade by this environmental law. A secret panel, three-member panel in Geneva, ruled that the Marine Mammal Protection Act had to be struck down or the U.S. would face trade sanctions on a broad range of issues unrelated. This became a poster child, if you will, for the fair trade campaign. It showed that the existing structure of GATT and what will also be established with NAFTA, the dispute resolution structure, takes power away from local people, local right to set our laws and our standards for the environment, for health, and those kinds of things, and puts it at an international super government, if you will, which is accountable to no one, elected by no one, and operates in complete secrecy without public, the things that we take for granted, public testimony, public input, public hearings, things like that. When President Bush, when this GATT ruling on tuna and dolphin was handed down, President Bush lobbied Congress to do away with the Marine Mammal Protection Act instead of standing up for our law. So we're going to have that same type of dispute resolution panel under the NAFTA.
I've seen also another example of this. Thailand was wanting to protect their citizens from the evils of smoking and to protect the health of their people. Well, GATT ruled that that was a restraint of trade, and so now Thailand is forced to allow cigarettes into the country. This is the type of thing we're talking about. I guess we've seen just in microcosm what the GATT world and NAFTA will be like down at the border with the maquiladora situation. Can you tell us about the maquiladoras and just how it's set up?
The maquiladora program is an in-bond program along the border, which was started in 1965. At that point in time, you had just a few corporations going to Mexico. Today, you have over 2,000 plants that are maquiladoras along the border, stretching from Matamoros all the way over to Tijuana. And many of these plants have component parts of many different industries. General Motors is by far the largest employer along the border. They have somewhere in the vicinity of 54 plants already across the border in which car components are made. So in some of the plants you have car radios being produced. Perhaps in other plants you have car seat covers being produced, dashboards, the wiring for the harnesses. And these maquiladoras pay no taxes. So that's also one of the benefits to this program along the border.
Now, we've seen that they pay no taxes. What about the environment? I've heard some terrible environmental problems, particularly along the border. Mary, you're aware of what's happening down the Rio Grande. Can you tell us about that?
The border area is virtually a sewer. Probably the world's most polluted river, which is the New River in California, comes from the Maquiladora area. It is so polluted, 20 types of toxic chemicals have been found in it. Polioviruses have been found in it. The EPA has advised people not even to go near it. Also, the companies in the Maquiladora area are not responsible corporate citizens. What they do is they dump their hazardous and toxic waste into the rivers, into the sewer systems, into landfills. They are not protecting the workers in Mexico. It's really a form of abuse of citizens and workers, and that pollution comes over to the United States because rivers and groundwater flow downhill. They don't necessarily flow north and south. That's why the New River is so polluted. It comes from Mexico, but it flows into the United States. some of our towns in Texas, their aquifer where they get their drinking water supplies, are so polluted that children by age 8, a large percentage of them, have hepatitis and have had hepatitis. By age 30, 90% of the population has had hepatitis. It's from this polluted groundwater coming from Mexico, from these maquiladoras. So it is a terrible situation. The corporate, the companies that are there are really committing crimes against the environment and the people. A spot survey was made. 75% of the plants release toxic chemicals into the nearby area, some up to 6,500 times in excess of what is allowed in the United States.
But what are some of the other U.S. corporations that are operating in Mexico?
Well, the list is really a who's who of the Fortune 500. Most of your Fortune 500 companies have maquiladoras. So you're talking about Ford, Chrysler, AT&T, ITT, Baxter, DuPont, Johnson & Johnson, Hallmark even has a maquiladora.
The environmental situation is bad. I imagine they're not doing much in a positive way for their workers, are they?
The working conditions are really atrocious. If we allowed those kinds of conditions in the United States, our population would be so angry, they would demand that that company not even operate within their town because the working conditions are cruel. It's just really cruelty. Children put their hands in toxic chemicals. The wages are so low, 88 cents an hour, that there's no way that a family or a person can survive. Susan can speak of the actual wage conditions, but the environmental conditions, it's really a form of cruelty. It's dangerous, it's unhealthful, it's cruelty. It's probably the same that occurred in the early 1900s in the United States. Probably worse, actually, because they're dealing with so many more toxic chemicals than they did in the early era.
Shows that the capitalists haven't changed at all, have they? They've just made, since the 1800s and 1900s, when they just ran rampant all over American and workers, well, workers worldwide, they're still the same.
That's right. Ignorance was the excuse then. Greed is the answer now.
Mm-hmm. Just to give an example of what wage levels might look like at Zenith, which produces televisions and in Reynosa, Matamoros, and Juarez, many other parts along the border there, they have a training wage which is just over $21 a week. And we know that some of the workers that have worked there for many years are still receiving only about $30 a week, $30 to $35 a week, having worked there for 8 to 10 years. Now, you also have to take into consideration that the turnover at these maquiladora plants is tremendous. Companies think that they have a good turnover rate if their rate per year is 50%. At some of the plants in Nogales and other areas, the turnover rate is 150% per year.
American CEOs claim that the wages in Mexico, of course, are competitive with the U.S., and this is part of their justification for paying these low wages. But how do the maquiladora wages actually relate? How do they compare to typical Mexican wages?
Mexican manufacturing wages outside of the maquiladoras range from about $1.57 an hour to $2 an hour. And so here you're looking at a lesser wage than even Mexican manufacturing plants. And as Marianne was saying earlier, it's hard to justify. In 1914, Henry Ford paid his workers $5 a day so that the workers would be able to buy the products which they produced. We're in 1992, and the wages in some of these plants are still $5 a day in 1992.
What have the Mexican workers done to organize against these conditions? Have they tried to form unions? And what has been the response of the Mexican government?
In some of the areas, you do have unions. Matamoros has a strong union in that area. And as a result of that, they have been able to get a 40-hour work week, which is unique along the border. everywhere else at the border, your work week is 45 to 48 hours a week for very low wages. And the wages are actually a bit higher in Matamoros due to the stronger union. But recently, the union leader, Agapito Gonzalez, was whisked away in the middle of the night while he was negotiating for higher wages for the maquiladoras in that area, and kept under house arrest in Mexico City, and was released in October of 1992. So he was kept there from the end of January until October 1992, finally charged with tax evasion, and tried to break his spirit.
What are the living conditions like if the wages are low and the health situation is bad? The people must be living under horrible conditions.
The neighborhoods are called colonias, and many of the workers that work in these factories live in the colonias, in cardboard shacks, sometimes plywood shacks, saving bits and pieces of anything to build onto their houses, and no running water, no plumbing, no sewage disposal. It's very bleak conditions that many of the workers live under. Recently, the Maquiladora Association in Brownsville and Matamoros told Senator Metzenbaum that none of the workers in these Maquiladora factories live in those colonias. And he told them, I have been to the colonias, I have asked the people there, where do you work? And they said, I work in these Maquiladora factories. I work at GM or GE or Ford, or I work in these factories. And we know that the workers there, many of them, two, three, four, five in a family, are trying to make a living by working in these Maquiladora factories.
One of the reasons that the toxic dumping by the corporations is so hideous is because they essentially dump right into the drinking water of these poor people that are living near the Maquiladoras, because they don't have proper sewage disposal, they don't have a clean water system, mm-hmm. and the toxic waste that go right into the river are just pulled right out by the people and used as drinking water. It's also put in trenches that go right through their villages.
What are some of the effects of this?
That's been recent, that the statistics are starting to come to light about how many babies are actually being born without brains along the border. And there's concern because not all of the cases are being documented. The rates may be much higher than actually has been documented. The rate in Brownsville along that area is about four times the national average on the Brownsville side. And it's been difficult to get information from the Mexican side also, so that the statistics are complete for the area. And it's very concerning because these neural tube defects in the medical literature are linked to solvents such as xylene and toluene. And when the National Toxics Campaign in 1990 went along the border and documented what was in many of these ditches and canals and waterways, high levels of xylene were found in ditches at Stepan Chemical Company and at the General Motors plant, Ramir, which makes bumpers in Matamoros, as well as other plants along the border.
I think it's rather ironic, that as I understand it, these things which these factories, the United States factories down there produced, don't even go to Mexico. The Mexicans can't even buy them.
The advantage to an American corporation is that they can move south of the border, be right practically in the United States, pay no taxes, export to the United States duty-free, not have to pay for environmental cleanup, not have to meet OSHA standards, not have to provide health benefits to their workers, pay workers subsistent wages, which are barely subsistent. It's basically a very lucrative prospect for these corporations. And where does the money go? Well, you don't see it. The consumer doesn't see it. You're not paying less for your Ford Escort. You're not paying less for your pair of tennis shoes. But the money goes into the pockets of the stockholders of the corporation.
During the presidential debates, one of the things that Ross Perot said was that if NAFTA is signed, you will hear a large sucking sound of American industry moving to Mexico to avoid the environmental laws.
Now, the folks who are for this are saying, well, there will be minor adjustments, a little bit of unemployment, but in the long run, it's going to result in more jobs for the United States, higher wages for the United States, and also for the Mexicans themselves. So everything will balance out and be equal. Well, what do you think about that?
Well, if, everything will equal this way. Our wages will come down and theirs will come up. Mexican people do deserve higher wages, and they do need a development program. But the entire philosophy this is based on, if you will, is exploiting cheap labor. If Mexican labor comes up in cost to American manufacturers, this is a race to the bottom. It'll simply mean that American corporations quit going to Mexico and they start going to Nicaragua or Sri Lanka, Haiti, any number of other places where indeed they do go. The interesting thing about this free trade agreement is that it institutionalizes certain changes that the Salinas government has made to make it safer from an American investor's viewpoint to actually move operations down there. The Mexican political system has been somewhat unstable from an investor's standpoint up to this point. This institutionalizes certain changes that Salinas has made.
I guess Mexican farmers are going to be able to compete with U.S. farmers. Has anything started happening with this already? Do we have any foreshadowings of the impact on American farming, especially the small-time family farmer?
Well, we have one indication, and that is under the GATT rules, which NAFTA will follow, that we do not allow certain chemicals in our foods, and we do not allow plants and foods that have those chemicals to come into the United States, and DDT is an example. So it's very possible under this that those regulations will be challenged and DDT will be allowed in this country.
As a matter of fact, there was a GATT panel which said that American standards were too high and they were going to let five times the amount of DDT into the United States than what we have here. So if we thought we got rid of DDT, it's coming back via GATT.
The other thing that I'd like to point out, too, is that under the ejido system, the farms in Mexico, the ejidos are the farms, have been protected with certain tariffs, and this is going to be phased out so that the small farmers there would be having to actually compete with the large farms in the United States to grow corn or other crops. And there's no way to compete with the mechanization in the United States. So this could force many campesinos or small landowners off of their land, having had that land be bought up by big conglomerates in Mexico. And then what do those people do after they've lost their farms and their means of livelihood? And that's estimated to be perhaps as much as 1 million people over the next few years if that provision actually goes into effect.
I might add, you know, this hurts the little guy in both countries. As Susan pointed out, the bean and corn farmers, the small farmers on fairly arid soil in most of Mexico are eking out an existence, and they cannot compete with the Iowa agribusiness. On the other hand, small-time citrus growers in the valley, sugar producers in Florida and in Texas, these types of farmers, table produce in the United States, many of these people will not be able to compete with low land and wage costs in Mexico, and consequently, they're going to be out of business. What happens? Well, small towns dry up that are based on small farm income. You have this increasing dependence on agribusiness, large-scale farming, large-scale chemical and fertilizer use, and so essentially the small farmer in the U.S. gets hurt and the small farmer in Mexico gets hurt, and who wins but the giant grain movers, the ConAgras of the world, the Cargills of the world.
I wanted to go back and just answer your question of who is going to benefit under this NAFTA. basically, the way that I see it, it will be the large U.S. multinational corporations because of the wage scale, because of being able to dump toxics, et cetera, at this point. And also in Mexico, I think some of the main families that own Mexico will benefit. The rest of us will not benefit. And so in this case, it would have been wonderful for the present administration to be able to get NAFTA through in the middle of the night when no one was looking, so that all of this could have been in place. But the more people find out about what is actually in this NAFTA, I think the more disturbed people will become. And so that's why programs like this and many educational efforts are so necessary, because we need to find out what is actually in this 2,000-page document so that we can intelligently talk about it and intelligently respond. Is this what we want for the next 50 to 60 years as our policies?
What stance has President Clinton taken on NAFTA? Is he in favor of it?
He said he, during the campaign, he said that he did favor free trade, but that he needed to look at protections for the environment and for the workers. And I want to say just one quick thing about this program and how important it is for citizens to become involved. One of the things I think we've all seen as we've watched Russia disintegrate and looked more closely at the environmental damage, not just the environmental damage, it's really health damage. Toxins are poisons that kill people. We've seen from looking at Russia the result of the fact that when citizens are not able to challenge their government to insist that they have good environmental and health laws, there were no groups, there were no environmental groups in Russia. Individual citizens were not allowed to speak out on those issues. Some of the areas in Russia, in those countries, are almost completely and totally destroyed.
Well, now, Susan, you've been down to these maquiladoras and you've talked with some of the corporate people running and managing these outfits down there. What have they had to say about the situation?
Well, they see this as an opportunity to be able to further their goals. And the Coalition for Justice in the Maquiladoras and other groups have been formed to make corporations be more responsible in their practices. The coalition has put together a code of conduct asking corporations to at least adhere as a minimum to the U.S.-Mexican laws that are already in place. And those are laws around environment, health and safety of workers, the wages and benefits, and then the infrastructure of the areas in which these corporations have located. And some corporations are actually studying this code of conduct to see what their response will be.
Now, we were talking about Bill Clinton, and of course he's such a temporizer and kind of wishy-washy when it comes to trying to make a decision on anything. He was saying, well, as you said, that he would make sure that there was some type of safeguards. Well, they have safeguards down there. It's just that they're not enforced. Mexico has nice environmental standards and labor laws, do they not?
Yes, they do. They have good labor laws and good environmental laws on the books, and these have to be enforced. Enforcement is the key in this whole discussion. They are not being enforced. And the A government accounting office went down on a project, I think it was in June of 1992, and surveyed some of the latest maquiladoras that were set up to see if they had their proper permits and had submitted all of these to the government as they should have, and they had not. In the six factories that they went to, there was lacking documentation in all of these, and this was just very recent. So it's not just factories that set up long ago, but it's also factories that are just being set up now that are still not in compliance.
And yet, under the North American Free Trade Agreement, and GATT particularly, if they do enforce environmental regulations and safety regulations, they can be held in violation of the GATT and the NAFTA, because they'd be some hindrance to the production of profits and free trade. So it looks like they couldn't even enforce these laws even if they wanted to.
Can you give us any idea of what the cost has been to the U.S. economy just under the Maquiladora program? You said that almost 2,000 factories are operating in Mexico now. I assume that without this border agreement that was enacted by U.S. and Mexico in 1965, these factories would have remained in the U.S. So about how many jobs have been lost in the U.S. as a consequence of this, aside from the environmental damage that's been wreaked and which we'll have to pay for the cleanup of someday?
Well, that's hard to say. It's hard, so many different issues involved in whether one worker here at a certain level of productivity equals one worker in Mexico, and whether there's a direct relationship. But it is interesting to point out that the predictions of job loss under NAFTA. There are administration studies by the Bush administration and by others that say that NAFTA will mean 60,000 U.S. jobs increased, 100,000 jobs in the U.S. increased. That's based on projections of exports to Mexico going up and increased Mexican standard of living so they can buy more American products. And then they also admit that in the short term we'll lose 150,000 jobs. Well, those estimates are based on economic models which, number one, assume no net shift in investment, and number two, assume full employment, both of which are ludicrous to assume. The whole NAFTA is about shift in investment. That's what NAFTA is for, so companies can invest in Mexico and feel safe and secure about it. When you plug reasonable numbers in, like economists at the Economic Policy Institute and economists at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and Skidmore College, you come up with figures more like U.S. job losses at around 290,000 to 490,000 jobs lost to NAFTA in the next 5 to 10 years. So it's instructive to see how figures can be manipulated by economists and how economists can pretty much come up with any kind of answer they want to.
Depends on who's paying them.
Right? Depends on who's paying them, yeah.
I'd like to pick up on that also to talk about how many jobs have been lost in Canada since the trade pact with the United States and Canada went into effect in 1988. There's many estimates that are coming out of Canada that say already they've lost between 300 and 400,000 jobs there. Now, let's just take this example. Canada has a higher wage than the United States. So let's just say they were paying maybe $12 an hour and the United States was paying $10 an hour, and there was this much of a shift in all of the jobs coming across the border into the U.S. Well, let's just take then and think about in terms of Mexico and the United States. In the United States, we're paying $4.25 an hour. In Mexico, you're paying that much a day. And many of your workers are receiving less than $2,000 a year in these maquiladora plants. So there is going to be a shift just because of the wage differential. And if there was that much of a shift between Canada and the United States, we really need to think about what that shift is going to look like in terms of the United States and Mexico if this goes into effect.
Could you tell us something about the negotiation process that gave us NAFTA? It seems like it almost came as a fait accompli. We get these ceremonies periodically saying, well, we've made a great deal of progress in trade, now we've signed a free trade agreement, but actually the contents of the free trade agreement were only released recently. Who was privy to the negotiations, and why were they kept secret for that matter?
It was very carefully and cleverly done so that the American public could not know what was in the agreement. It was negotiated in secret, and then the announcements were made that the agreement had been signed, but we weren't told what was in it, only that we should applaud it and go along with it. And then other leaders, political leaders, were encouraged to support it, even though they didn't know what was in it. So there was this bandwagon attempt to try to get people to support it without the people knowing what was in it, the politicians knowing what was in it. And it was done so that multinational corporations could have this advantage over the American citizens.
Well, there are people who do know what's in it, and people who did have some influence in the say of how this came about. They were corporate advisors. They were a who's who, again, of the Fortune 500. There, I believe, were about 2,000 advisors in all these different committees on every different sector you can imagine, things from software to steel to corn to everything. And the representatives on these panels were entirely taken from corporate America and corporate Mexico. After there was a great public outcry, they made a token environmental committee and a token labor committee, which basically had no influence anyway, would not get the documents until months after they'd already been negotiated. We didn't get the documents until over a month after the grand ceremony that Bush used for his re-election campaign, his failed re-election campaign, came out in August. Finally, on September 8th, the document was released, 2,000 pages, and already people were singing its praises. I'm sure they hadn't read the 2,000-page document. Another interesting thing to note is that they had what was known as bracketed text. Brackets means it's still open for negotiation. Bush conveniently released this during the election campaign as his wonderful foreign policy achievement, which is going to mean jobs, jobs, jobs. And yet, the document isn't finished. The negotiations aren't concluded. Some very high percentage of the text was still bracketed. So there are people with their finger, their hand in the pot, if you will. People who do have access, but those people are not normal citizens. They're not you and me.
I'd like to give an example of how this process went in Seattle, which was the first session when Mark Wilson and Jaime Sarapuche and Carla Hills got together to talk about the trade agreement. Many of us were there to talk about, what were some of the concerns, and we had to make our concerns known through street theater and rallies and prayer services. Down below, the three negotiators and all of their entourage were secluded on the 76th floor of a high rise, and so we sent up a balloon to say, how about fair trade now? And Carla Hills actually arrived late at one of the negotiating sessions and had to walk through all of this street theater and the hundreds and hundreds of people that were gathered there below. And she wouldn't even speak to us. And so, it re-emphasizes the fact that all of this was done shrouded in secrecy at very high levels of high rises while the rest of us were there to give input if only asked.
How do you assess the fact that the mass media in the United States, the establishment media, haven't said boo one about this? You have to read the alternative press in order to find out anything about it.
I have an answer to that. The media in this country is a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America. That's number one. And number two, communications provisions in the NAFTA are very favorable to U.S. Media and U.S. Broadcasters, Time Warner, intellectual property rights, all that's very favorable. Copyright restrictions and things like that are going to really help the Time Warner Corporation, the big movie studios, who are all part of the media oligarchy, if you will. So they have a real interest in NAFTA, and so they're not likely when the company that owns your newspaper and your Time magazine is not going to be reporting NAFTA if it's going to be able to sell its movies in Mexico more readily. It's going to be able to protect its copyrights more readily, things like that.
Sure, and when you have, I think NBC is owned by General Electric, yeah. So you're not going to have General Electric allow NBC to go on and to say that one of their workers in their maquiladora factories had a miscarriage during her shift and was not allowed to go to the hospital. I mean, that type thing is never going to be reported.
And that did happen there?
That did happen.
Hmm. What's your final assessment of this and the whole world which we're getting into, the New World Order?
Well, my assessment is that we have to be so careful because environmental issues are health issues. as well as birds and bugs and beauty, and they affect us all. And if we don't make sure that our laws are safeguarded, no one will do it for us. We have to do it on our own, and we're going to have to fight every step of the way to get those laws safeguarded and have stronger environmental laws, which are essentially stronger health laws. Already, our cancer rates are too high. Most scientists agree that there are environmental causes of cancer. And so we need to be stronger, not weaker.
I think that we have truth on our side, and we will have to continue to speak the truth, document the truth, and continue to speak it at every level. I mean, that's what gives me the courage to keep speaking and to keep talking. And we've got to alert our president, our legislators, and everyone that we know of what consequences this NAFTA and GATT are going to have on us, not just for this generation, but the next generation also.
Well, my assessment is that this is almost an inevitable process of global integration. Corporations are moving overseas. You're having bits of things made here in Mexico, bits of things made in Korea, Ireland, all coming together and being put together at a third location and then sold in the developed world. The thing that's going to have to happen is people are going to have to organize across borders. We've learned a great deal from Canadian activists. People are going to have to start looking globally at struggling against the powers that be. We're going to have to start getting together, and we're going to have to look at forming protections that bring standards up rather than down. One thing I think is interesting about the free trade agreement with Mexico. This is the first time that two such different countries have tried to integrate economically. In Europe, they set up protections for workers. They made basic human rights a condition. They made child labor laws a condition of entry into the European community. They've integrated over 35 years. And they're not perfect. But what we're going to have to do is work together to get development from the first world to help the third world. If we're going to economically integrate, it should not be just a means for giant multinational corporations to exploit Mexican workers. We're going to have to try to use this opportunity, because integration is going to happen. We've got to use this opportunity to bring their standards up, and then things will level out more. Then there won't be necessarily so many incentives to throw American workers off their jobs and move their plant to Mexico if the Mexican workers are being protected and if the Mexican environment is being protected.
GATT and NAFTA is a slick attempt by multinational corporations to circumvent the will of the people, the democracies, the laws that the citizens of countries have enacted in order to protect their health and environment.
You're watching Alternative Views, coming to you from Austin, Texas. Now we have time for some news stories from the Alternative Press.
Well, Molly Ivins has a very good article in Mother Jones on the Whiggy Republicans. Of all the things that the Republican Party cares about today, what its issues are and what it doesn't care about, what it ignores. She points out that the party spans several classes, ranging from the top corporate executives to lower middle class types. It includes everything from Wall Street to really far out right-wing Christians, which she calls the Whiggy Republicans. She says the basic split on the right is between those that really believe that the Reagan revolution was a grand triumph and those that are trying to figure out what went wrong. Robert Bartley, who's the editor of the Wall Street Journal, is one of those that really thinks that the Reagan revolution was great stuff. He wrote a book called Seven Fat Years, where he claimed that this was one of the greatest economic times of recent American history, that inflation was gone and prosperity reigned for seven fat years. Well, Ivins points out that he seems entirely unfazed by the news that 70% of the wealth created in the decade went to the wealthiest 1% of the people, whereas serious politicals on the right, like Kevin Phillips, is concerned that precisely this phenomenon caused the end of the Republican Party politically, that it simply became an instrument of the rich and neglected a broad range of people who otherwise had Republican Party allegiances. Now, the Whiggy Republicans are precisely the ones involved in values and family values. The folks you saw speaking at the Republican convention, Dan Quayle, who was attacking Murphy Brown and Hollywood and the cultural elite. But Ivins points out that this goes very deep into the Republican right. It's not just Danny Boy that was concerned about the Hollywood elite and cultural values, but that Oliver Stone has been a major target by serious right-wingers on the last years. That Stone is emblematic of the brooding, glooming, befouling vapors of culture smog, that public health hazard produced by the politics of the infantile left and by the conjurings of terrific Monty Banks. That's according to R. Emmett Tyrell, the editor of the American Spectator, who has quite a prose style. But also David Horowitz, who used to put out Ramparts and then moved to the far right, has been focusing in recent years on the evils of Hollywood and attacking the cultural elite. These right-wing Whiggy Republicans don't seem to be too concerned about AIDS, drugs, racism, and poverty. They're concerned about Hollywood and family values. But the really interesting thing that raises the question of what actually has happened in the last 12 years was a chart that Mother Jones put out right after Molly Ivins' article in their September-October 1982 issue, where they raised the question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, and pointed out that the national debt is up 57% over the last 4 years. The budget deficit is up 157%. And the Americans that are unemployed for 6 months or longer involve no less than 1,127,000 individuals, up 133% over 4 years ago. The mean annual income of the wealthiest 5% of American families, by contrast, went up 5% in the last 4 years, whereas the mean annual income of the poorest one-fifth went down 5%. So this is obvious class war of the Bush administration, taking from the poorest fifth and giving to the richest fifth. The hourly earnings for blue-collar workers went down 10% in the last 4 years. The number of millionaires, on the other hand, went up 81%. Americans with no health insurance went up 15% in the last years. Family receiving aid to families with dependent children went up 25% in the last 4 years. Medium monthly payments to these families, by contrast, went down 12%. Children living in poverty up 4%. Violent crimes up 21%. That's pretty heavy. Americans in prison up 28%. Americans on death row up 22%. So obviously things were very, very bad for the poor, for the middle class during the last 4 years, and not too bad for those in the upper 20% and particularly the upper 1%.
Doug, in a recent story for us, you indicated in your analysis of the election showing that you knew that Bush was going to lose when the establishment press started dumping on him. Did you get these quotes? There were a couple of them here. One from Tom Wicker, who was 30 years with the New York Times. He said that Bush got a free ride from the press during his first 2 years in office. But gradually, his sheer incompetence and shallowness came to the fore. And I think the reporters see it. They see that Bush is nothing more than an opportunist, and perhaps not as admirable a figure as when they first saw him as president. Boy, that's pretty pathetic when they think that an obvious phony was anybody who was admirable in the first place. And I don't see where they gave him a free ride stopped after the first 2 years. Do you?
Well, on the eve of the Gulf War, Bush had very, very low ratings and was getting attacked by all the pundits for not having any policies domestically, and everyone was saying then it was going to be a one-term presidency. Well, the Gulf War, of course, resurrected Bush's image, and for about a year he was able to ride on those laurels, but by the end of that it was clear he had no domestic policies, no vision, he was corrupt, he was incompetent, he was incapable of dealing with the problems of the present. He had no vision for the future. So even the smart people in the ruling class pulled away from him. I read an editorial by David Rockefeller Jr. in the New York Times and saw that several other major business leaders had pulled away from Bush and went to Clinton, as did the New York Times and a lot of the elite media, simply because I think Bush was such a disaster for the system that they wanted to get rid of him and to get someone more competent in.
Well, the Treasure State Review had another quote regarding Bush, this one from that insufferable right-winger George Will. He said that he didn't like the, quote, intellectual slum that is the Bush campaign, with its riffraff of liars and aspiring Ayatollahs. Now, isn't that strange? He never talked like that when, during the Reagan years, didn't criticize that rabble of liars and aspiring arrogant Ayatollahs either. So it's curious that the press turned against Bush at the last minute, but they gave Reagan an absolute free ride the whole time.
Well, Reagan was a good actor who was able to at least look presidential. Plus, he was a guy who enabled the Wall Street elite basically to run the country. So the business leaders loved the deregulation of the Reagan years. They loved the tax breaks, and they loved the fact that basically business was running the country. Whereas Bush himself was playing a heavy-handed role in his administration, made a lot of bad economic decisions, and so they were basically more eager to get rid of him than they were Reagan, who was just simply a pliable puppet who could always be counted on to do whatever the corporate elite wanted to.
That's the end of this Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'd like to thank our crew. Brian Lynch was our director, Ashley Blake, and Mary McDonald also assisted. For our news section, Eric Eubank was our camera person, and Kevin L. West was our audio man. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. We're very glad you could join us. Goodbye.